Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Wednesday, June 26th, 2024. I'm Lee Robartis. In the news tonight, U.S. Supreme Court posts decision against Idaho's Health of the Mother abortion law, then takes the decision down off their website. Apparently, it was posted prematurely, that as maternal medicine doctors are leaving the state with likely healthcare deserts. Pullman City Council hears discussion of proposed Gaza ceasefire resolution. Idaho libraries try to figure out how to react to the state's new library law that allows private action to sue. And Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest Chief Probert makes sudden departure. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The U.S. Supreme Court posted a decision on its website today saying Idaho would not be allowed to deny emergency abortions to a pregnant person whose health is in danger if the emergency room is in a hospital that receives Medicare money, which is practically all of them. Bloomberg reported the court took down the opinion, which was apparently posted prematurely. The court had been expected to publish its final decision in the Idaho case by the end of the week. If true, the Supreme Court decision would be temporary while the case makes its way through the lower courts. Bloomberg News reported in a separate opinion, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson wrote, "Today's decision is not a victory for pregnant patients in Idaho. It is a delay." As briefly posted on the Supreme Court website, the decision was 6-3 to delay allowing Idaho's anti-abortion law to go fully into effect, with Samuel Alito, Clarence Thomas, and Neil Gorsuch voting against. The Biden administration's Justice Department sued Idaho shortly after the trigger law, which makes it a felony for a doctor to perform an abortion at any stage of pregnancy, punishable by 5 years in prison, went into effect in 2022. The Idaho law has exceptions for rape and incest, but only if there is a police report filed in time. It also has an exception for when the life of the mother is in danger without an abortion, but maternal medicine doctors, including those few that specialize in difficult pregnancies, have been leaving the state because they don't want to have to parse out whether the patient's life is in danger or the patient's health is in danger in an emergency situation and face possible prison time and loss of their medical licenses. The Justice Department maintains the Idaho law violates the 1996 Federal Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act. Lower courts have ruled only on the emergency abortion part of Idaho's law, and in early January, the U.S. Supreme Court lifted the lower court's injunctions so hospitals in Idaho no longer had protection under federal law for providing abortion care to protect the health of the mother. In April, as the High Court was considering Idaho's case, St. Luke's Medical Center in the Treasure Valley, which is the state's largest provider of emergency services, said it had to send 6 pregnant patients out of state to Salt Lake City or other states during emergencies, something that was mentioned during oral arguments. Despite the decision, American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists Chief Legal Officer Molly Meegan told the cable television channel CNN the Supreme Court decision does not sufficiently clear up the issue. Meegan said it doesn't solve the problem at all. In fact, pregnant patients are still trying to obtain care and unable to get it, and physicians are trying to provide care without clear parameters and with draconian criminal penalties hanging over their heads if they get the question wrong. During oral arguments in April, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson drilled down on whether state law takes precedent over the Federal Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, also known as EMTALA, which requires the stabilization of emergency patients. Here's Jackson questioning Joshua Turner of the conservative Christian law firm Alliance Defending Freedom, who Idaho Attorney General Raul Labrador hired to argue the case before the U.S. Supreme Court.
I think you have to concede that with respect to certain medical conditions, abortion is the standard of care because your own statute, as interpreted by your own courts, acknowledges that when a condition gets bad enough such that the woman's life is in peril, then the doctors are supposed to give abortions. And the reason that that's true is that with respect to certain rare but extremely obviously important conditions and circumstances, abortion is the accepted medical standard of care. Isn't that right?
Yes, and that was my point, that there is a life-saving exception under Idaho law. Now, the question here
the question is it also the accepted standard of care when, rather than the woman's life being in peril, the woman's health is in peril? So let's take, all of these cases are rare, but within these rare cases, there's a significant number where the woman is, her life is not in peril, but she's going to lose her reproductive organs. She's going to lose the ability to have children in the future, unless an abortion takes place. Now, that's the category of cases in which Amtala says, my gosh, of course the abortion is necessary to assure that no material deterioration occurs. And yet Idaho says, sorry, no abortion here. And the result is that these patients are now helicoptered out of state.
Yeah. Your Honor, the hypothetical you raise is a very difficult situation. And these situations, I mean, nobody's arguing that they don't raise tough medical questions that implicate deeply theological and moral questions. And Idaho, like 22 other states, and even Congress and EMTALA, recognizes that there are two patients to consider in those circumstances. And the two-patient scenario is tough when you have these competing interests.
You know, that would be a good response if federal law did not take a position on what you characterize as a tough question. But federal law does take a position on that question. It says that you don't have to wait until the person is on the verge of death. If the woman is going to lose her reproductive organs, that's enough to trigger this duty on the part of the hospital to stabilize the patient. And the way to stabilize patients in these circumstances, all doctors agree.
That was U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson speaking during oral arguments in April and questioning Joshua Turner. Idaho Coalition for Safe Healthcare member Dr. Kara Cadwalader told CNN last week her hospital had to send a pregnant person out of state for emergency abortion care. Cadwalader said she's excited about the ruling, even if it's a small step. She said, beyond all the political reasons, it's incredibly important for pregnant patients here in Idaho who now will be able to access emergency care appropriately. Idaho library managers have been rewriting agreements, consulting with legal counsel, and sometimes placing limits on how minors can enter their buildings as House Bill 710 is set to go into effect Monday. Libraries are bracing for what might happen if people abuse the new state law and try to remove any books that happen to mention homosexuality or have stories about the lives of trans people. There's concern about the vagueness of the law. The law creates a statewide policy for reviewing materials that could be considered harmful to minors if a patron challenges the book. Under the law, officials have 60 days to remove or relocate the book to an adults-only section if the library has one. If the book is not removed, the library could face a $250 fine and the patron could sue for damages. The bill has no provisions for challenging a decision to remove a book from a library. Ada Community Library Director Mary DeWalt, who is Idaho Library Association Vice Chair, says the new law is a constant, unavoidable threat hanging over librarians. DeWalt told the Idaho Education News, everything feels hard now. The small 1,000 24-square-foot library in Donnelly has decided to close its library to minors who are not accompanied by a parent or guardian. Donnelly Library Director Sherry Schielein told the Idaho Education News the facility does not have enough room for an adults-only section. Schielein said, "Donnelly is disproportionately impacted because we are so small. We do not have the space to move a book from one side of the library to the other side of the library. It just doesn't work that way." The library will offer parents a waiver which reads, "I understand the librarians have not been afforded the opportunity to review every item in their inventory and therefore are not responsible for the content of items that my child may check out. I affirm that my signature on this clause permits my child to circulate materials that may or may not have adult themes." You're tuned into the KRFP Evening Report on KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Love's Kombucha is proud to support KRFP Radio Free Moscow. Love's Kombucha is a fun, lively, fermented probiotic tea that is craft brewed right here in Moscow. For more information, visit loveskombucha.com.
Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest Supervisor Cheryl Probert has announced she will retire at the end of the week. Probert has worked for the Forest Service for 37 years and took the job as Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest Supervisor at the beginning of 2015 when she replaced Rick Brazell. While Probert's retirement is sudden, the Forest Service selected Probert as Nez Perce Clearwater Supervisor well before Brazell stepped down at the end of 2014. When she took the job, the Clearwater and Nez Perce forests were consolidating and moving the Forest Supervisor's office to Kamiai. Prior to working on the Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest, Probert worked as a rangeland specialist in southern Idaho and held wildlife biologist, environmental coordinator, forest planner, district ranger, and deputy forest supervisor positions in Idaho, Wyoming, Nevada, and Utah. Probert said in a press release, "I'm intensely proud that we have approved good neighbor authority agreements with tribal, state, and county governments so we can work collectively to get more work done on the forest and in our communities for years to come."
National Rivers Month comes to an end this week, and conservation groups say it's a reminder that more action is needed to protect Idaho's rivers. The state is home to more than 107,000 miles of river, providing drinking water, hydropower, tourism, and recreational opportunities like rafting and angling. But Stephen Pfeiffer with Idaho Rivers United says only a small portion of those river miles have the strongest type of federal protections.
Only 1% of the rivers here in Idaho are protected via Wild and Scenic River designation, and so there's a lot of opportunity to give more stretches of river that people like to recreate on or might rely on protections that they deserve.
Idaho is home to two of the eight rivers originally protected by the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act of 1968, the Middle Fork of the Clearwater River and the Middle Fork of the Salmon River. About 890 miles of river in Idaho are protected under this designation today. The Snake River also flows through Idaho. The Biden administration has been studying four dams on the lower part of the Snake River in eastern Washington and their effect on fish populations that migrate to and from Idaho. Last week, the administration announced the Columbia Basin Task Force to further examine the impact of those dams. Pfeiffer says salmon and steelhead numbers are dwindling because of the dams.
It all boils down to the fact that our wild salmon and steelhead don't have much time. But if we take these actions now, we can get them to a place where populations have stabilized and are in fact recovering in the event of dam removal.
Supporters of the dam say they provide hydropower to the region, as well as enabling other uses for the river, like barging and irrigation. Pfeiffer says National Rivers Month isn't only about threats to rivers. It's also about enjoying what they offer.
Idaho has so many amazing stretches of river, and there might be an amazing stretch right in your backyard that's just waiting to be explored.
For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Pullman City Council spent about 45 minutes last night hearing further discussion of a proposal from Democratic Socialists of the Palouse for the council to pass a resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. The council heard comments and discussed the issue at their previous meeting 2 weeks ago and decided to schedule discussion on the issue for last night's meeting at the request of council members Carla De Lira and Eric Fajerin, with the stipulation that the council not take action on the proposed resolution at this time. Here is some of last night's discussion moderated by Mayor Francis Benjamin.
My name is Andre Deal. I'm a PhD candidate in American Studies and an instructor in Comparative Ethnic Studies at WSU, as well as a member of UAW 4591, a city resident and a seasonal employee for the city. Following the city council meeting 2 weeks ago, a group of like-minded activists came together to form the coalition Pullman for Palestine. This evening, members of Pullman for Palestine will speak to council to address concerns and criticisms raised in the last meeting. Specifically, we'll be addressing the point raised by some council members that a resolution such as this would make Pullman less of a welcoming city, the idea that the resolution is too partisan, and council's suggestion that they're passing a resolution is a fundamentally symbolic action. It is our hope that this evening can produce a productive discussion around this complicated issue. Underpinning our arguments presented this evening is the belief that being critical of the relationship between the United States and the State of Israel, or the political project of Zionism, does not constitute anti-Semitism. As a Jewish person, I believe that flattening the wide range of positions on Israel and Zionism held in the diaspora into a monolith and weaponizing that false identity in service of justifying an action on a genocide serves to empower domestic and global anti-Semitism. Members of council echoed the centrality of this monolith in shaping the position of public officials when they alluded to the idea that they wanted Pullman to be a welcoming place for both its Jewish and Palestinian residents. This is a false equivalence rooted in a long history of anti-Semitic rhetoric. I believe that Pullman and the surrounding area has a problem with anti-Semitism. I personally experienced more casual anti-Semitism here than any other place I've lived, but it is my sincere belief that if council were to empower itself to vote on this ceasefire resolution in its current or an amended form, it would communicate to all of the city's residents that their elected officials are willing to take a stand to ensure their basic rights of their citizenry. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And this is a public comment time, so I please ask that you hold any response. Next person, please.
Hi, my name is Aiden. I moved to Pullman a couple weeks ago to attend Washington State. And I'd like to express my disappointment in the responses made by some council members regarding the ceasefire resolution. Your responses to public comment in the last meeting only served to perpetuate the growing feeling of disenfranchisement among young people. While it may be true that U.S. City Council members in Pullman don't have a significant impact on what happens in Palestine, and that in a vacuum this ceasefire resolution will not affect policy changes at a national level, it's disingenuous at best to employ this excuse as a response to our calls for solidarity. I find it more likely that you're purposely deflecting in order to avoid speaking about something that elicits uncomfortable feelings. Even more disingenuous is the excuse that this resolution, which is centered around solidarity with over 100 other U.S. cities in calling for the end to indiscriminate U.S.-funded bombing and collective punishment of over 2 million people, is too, quote, partisan for a city council to support. In my opinion, and I'm sure the opinion of many others here, the act of refusing to pass this resolution is a tacit endorsement of genocide, and I would welcome an explanation of how a refusal is any less partisan than what we are calling on you to support.
Good evening, Council and Mayor. My name is Becky Dubin. I live at 520 Northwest Sunset Drive. I have two main issues for you tonight. That this issue is already tearing Pullman apart, this ceasefire. There are so many more people against this issue than are for it. They may not show up tonight, but they are out there on social media and they're talking. We all know that. At the very, very least, it's dividing our city. The second issue I'd like to talk about is who's bringing this resolution in front of city council. Normally, as you well know, the resolution comes from city council or staff writes it, and it goes through legal. But I noticed this came from an organization called PDSA, and I looked them up and found that they are the Palouse Democratic Socialists of America, and they list their 2024 comrades on that page. I was surprised to see that the person who brought the motion forward today, Councilman De Lira, is listed as one of the comrades. I really have no problem with any city council member being a member of any group. What I find troubling is the disingenuous, thank you for the word, disingenuous not revealing of that from the very beginning. I asked Councilmember De Lira to explain that when the discussion comes up, why that was not revealed, or if this is some fake to explain that. And in fact, I turn that to every council member. If you're a member of this organization and haven't disclosed it, please do. Please be transparent. I don't know about the legal portion of that, but I know it's not ethical. Finally, I'd like to say that the last three generations before me of my family had direct experience with genocide. Some of them died in concentration camps. I do not support this resolution. It's not because you lack empathy. Do not fall for that false dilemma. This is a resolution that we should not even be discussing today because Pullman has too many issues to be discussing instead. I'm going to go downtown and support some businesses. Thank you.
Thank you. Next person.
Hello, my name is Megan. I'm a resident of Pullman and a Pullman for Palestine activist. I also graduated from WSU just a few years ago, so quite a few ties to this community. I would just like to say that the financial connection between our community and Israeli occupation, apartheid, and war crimes is clear and reasoned for action from Pullman City Council. The most direct connection that Pullman residents have with Israel's genocidal actions is the use of our tax dollars by the federal government to provide military aid to Israel. Normally, this is about $3.8 billion a year to provide Israel with a qualitative military edge, quote unquote, over all other forces in the region. But this actually just leaves Palestinians entirely subject to the whims and power of the Israeli government, which can choose at any time to carry out the sort of genocidal bombing campaign it is undertaking right now. Whether or not you see that, it is happening. The U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights website, notmytaxdollars.org, which allows you to calculate the amount of federal taxes paid locally that contribute to military aid to Israel, shows that Pullman residents contribute $436,365 in an ordinary year to fuel Israeli occupation and apartheid. However, this year, Joe Biden and Congress have decided to give Israel an extra $24 billion to carry out the current genocide. This is more than six times as much money as usual, and calculating Pullman's share based on the previously stated number shows that Pullman residents are contributing more than $2.7 million to the destruction of schools, hospitals, residential buildings, and humanitarian aid facilities just this year. As a member of the Pullman community, I don't want to be tied to these atrocities. And since I can't choose where my tax dollars go or choose not to pay them, I want my local representatives to make a clear political statement that this is not what Pullman stands for. Our success and growth as a community should not further atrocities committed in another place. And we shouldn't have to choose whether or not we support our local community and our local businesses or genocide. Thank you.
Thank you for your time. Next person.
Hello, my name is Elizabeth, and I'm a graduate student at WSU and a resident of Pullman. And I'd like to address the argument which was raised at the last council meeting that the proposed ceasefire resolution somehow makes Pullman less of a welcoming city. In fact, the ceasefire resolution concurs with Pullman's 2017 welcoming city resolution in recognizing equality as a precondition to being a welcoming community. The 2017 resolution states that no matter where we come from of our citizenship status, all residents and visitors feel welcome, will receive equal protection under the law in our city, and we are proud to call Pullman our home. The criterion of equal protection is daily denied to the millions of Palestinians living in Israel who are subject to numerous discriminatory laws. In the West Bank and East Jerusalem, millions of Palestinians are governed by martial law and are denied trial in civilian courts, their lands and homes regularly and violently seized by Israeli settlers. And of course, in Gaza, 2 million people are currently being denied the protection of international human rights laws, which bans the collective punishment of civilians, the denial of humanitarian aid, and the use of extermination as a method of war. In passing the resolution that was submitted to you, the council would be affirming and demanding the equality of all people between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea, regardless of their nationality or religion, which is an act of welcoming. As 2017 resolution recognizes, because to welcome someone, you must first recognize their basic equality with you. This resolution does not pick winners and losers. It only picks equals. To put an end to social inequality is not a loss for any group. It is the achievement of the fundamental aim of all democratic, racial justice, and anti-colonial movements, and therefore a collective victory for humanity. The resolution also commits the city to combat all forms of discrimination in the spirit of building a locally welcoming and equal community. Thank you.
You've been listening to various comments before the Pullman City Council last night on a proposal for a resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. The agenda item was for discussion only, and the council did not take action on the proposed resolution.
Gas-powered leaf blowers are seen as a nuisance to many, and research shows they could also be a health hazard. Portland, Oregon is on a campaign to phase them out in the coming years. The victory over gas-powered blowers is partly thanks to the work of the organization Quiet Clean PDX. Michael Hall is co-founder and co-chair of the Portland chapter of the Quiet Clean Alliance. He says there are many reasons to ban the gas-powered machines, including the toxic exhaust they release and the loud noise they create.
More importantly these days, to my mind, is there a danger to the environment, to our climate, because they emit so much carbon and greenhouse gases that there are contributors to the weather issues that we see more and more.
Research from the California Air Resources Board found 1 hour operating a gas leaf blower generates as much emissions as a car driving 1,100 miles. The blowers can also reach 100 decibels, akin to an airplane taking off. More than 100 U.S. cities have banned gas-powered leaf blowers, and more than 45 organizations are part of the Quiet Clean Alliance. Under the ordinance, Portland will phase out gas-powered leaf blowers year-round by 2028. But Hall notes there's still work to be done to ensure no one is disproportionately affected by the new law.
It's a victory at the city level. The real work is in implementing it and enacting it in a way that is fair and equitable, particularly for the small, BIPOC-owned lawn care businesses, and that is effective.
While electric blowers are better for the environment, they still stir up debris and pollutants like gas-powered blowers. Hall says the Leave the Leaves campaign advocates for not moving leaves from yards at all.
The Xerces Society has been a leader in saying, hey, what if we just leave the leaves and allow the pollinators to have an environment that they can grow in, that the birds can have enough of the insects, and that the pollinators can do their work.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. This story was produced with original reporting from Hannah Wallace for Reasons to Be Cheerful.
Advocates in Wyoming trying to get music therapy licensure recognized in the state are hitting roadblocks. Members of the Wyoming Music Therapy Task Force fielded questions last week from the state's Joint Labor, Health, and Social Services Committee. Music therapy can help relieve anxiety, dementia, and stroke symptoms, as well as aid people living with multiple sclerosis and Parkinson's disease, according to the National Center for Complementary and Integrative Health. Task Force Chair Hillary Camino told the committee she wants music therapy to be a protected title to increase access and so that practitioner qualifications are clear.
We often work with vulnerable populations, people who cannot advocate for themselves. So it is very important that we know what we're doing when working with those very vulnerable populations in a clinical setting.
Camino, who is a practitioner herself, says she's given up to 3 referrals per week to provide music therapy services in a hospital setting, and that there aren't enough providers to fulfill the need. The committee asked questions about what kind of training practitioners need, what kind of funding licensure would require, and under what state statute licensure would fall, before moving forward a bill draft for title protection. State Representative Dan Zwanitzer supported the idea of licensure and also noted that the idea moves what he says is against the tide of the current legislature.
The sense that I get from our colleagues, especially with some of the new groups out there, are the work is to lessen licensing across the field, and I think that is going to be kind of a strong issue in the 2025 session.
17 other states have enacted music therapy legislation, and similar bills have been brought to other legislatures. I'm Kathleen Shannon reporting for Wyoming News Service.
That's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow-Pullman area. Calling for 20% chance of showers between midnight and 5 a.m. tonight. Otherwise, mostly cloudy, low 51, breezy, west winds 15 to 20, gusts up to 30. 20% chance of precipitation tomorrow, a slight chance of showers between 9 a.m. and 4 p.m., but otherwise mostly sunny, high 68, breezy, west winds 15 to 20, gusts up to 30. Partly cloudy Thursday night, low 47, west winds 5 to 15, gusts up to 25, and sunny on Friday, high 74. Current temperature 79. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street,